Fox's Book of Martyrs. Chapter 8. An Account of the Persecutions in Bohemia Under the Papacy. The Roman pontiffs, having usurped a power over several churches, were particularly severe on the Bohemians, which occasioned them to send two ministers and four lay brothers to Rome, in the year 977, to obtain redress of the Pope. After some delay, their request was granted, and their grievances redressed. Two things in particular they were permitted to do, viz., to have divine service performed in their own language, and to give the cup to the laity in the sacrament. The disputes, however, soon broke out again, the succeeding popes exerting their whole power to impose on the minds of the Bohemians, and the latter, with great spirit, aiming to preserve their religious liberties. In AD 1375, some zealous friends of the gospel applied to Charles, King of Bohemia, to call an ecumenical council for an inquiry into the abuses that had crept into the church, and to make a full and thorough reformation. The king, not knowing how to proceed, sent to the Pope for directions how to act, but the pontiff was so incensed at this affair that his only reply was, "Severely punish those rash and profane heretics." The monarch accordingly banished everyone who had been concerned in the application, and, to oblige the Pope, laid a great number of additional restraints upon the religious liberties of the people. The victims of persecution, however, were not so numerous in Bohemia until after the burning of John Huss and Jerome of Prague. These two eminent reformers were condemned and executed at the instigation of the Pope and his emissaries, as the reader will perceive by the following short sketches of their lives. Persecution of John Huss. John Huss was born at Husinitz, a village in Bohemia, about the year 1380. His parents gave him the best education their circumstances would admit, and having acquired a tolerable knowledge of the classics at a private school, he was removed to the University of Prague, where he soon gave strong proofs of his mental powers, and was remarkable for his diligence and application to study. In 1398, Huss commenced Bachelor of Divinity, and was after successively chosen pastor of the Church of Bethlehem, in Prague, and dean and rector of the university. In these stations he discharged his duties with great fidelity, and became, at length, so conspicuous for his preaching, which was in conformity with the doctrines of Wycliffe, that it was not likely he could long escape the notice of the Pope and his adherents, against whom he inveighed with no small degree of asperity. The English reformist, Wycliffe, had so kindled the light of Reformation that it began to illumine the darkest corners of popery and ignorance. His doctrines spread into Bohemia, and were well received by great numbers of people, but by none so particularly as John Huss, and his zealous friend and fellow martyr, Jerome of Prague. The Archbishop of Prague, finding the reformists daily increasing, issued a decree to suppress the further spreading of Wycliffe's writings, but this had an effect quite different to what he expected, for it stimulated the friends of those doctrines to greater zeal, and almost the whole university united to propagate them. Being strongly attached to the doctrines of Wycliffe, Huss opposed the decree of the archbishop, who, however, at length, obtained a bull from the Pope, giving him commission to prevent the publishing of Wycliffe's doctrines in his province. By virtue of this bull, the archbishop condemned the writings of Wycliffe. He also proceeded against four doctors who had not delivered up the copies of that divine, and prohibited them, notwithstanding their privileges, to preach to any congregation. Dr. Huss, with some other members of the university, protested against these proceedings, and entered an appeal from the sentence of the archbishop. The affair being made known to the Pope, he granted a commission to Cardinal Colonna to cite John Huss, to appear personally at the court of Rome, to answer the accusations laid against him, of preaching both errors and heresies. Dr. Huss desired to be excused from a personal appearance, and was so greatly favored in Bohemia that King Wenceslas, the queen, the nobility, and the university desired the Pope to dispense with such an appearance, as also that he would not suffer the kingdom of Bohemia to lie under the accusation of heresy, but permit them to preach the gospel with freedom in their places of worship. Three proctors appeared for Dr. Huss before Cardinal Colonna. They endeavored to excuse his absence and said they were ready to answer in his behalf. But the cardinal declared Huss contumacious and excommunicated him accordingly. The proctors appealed to the Pope and appointed four cardinals to examine the process. These commissioners confirmed the former sentence and extended the excommunication not only to Huss, but to all his friends and followers. From this unjust sentence Huss appealed to a future council, but without success, and, notwithstanding so severe a decree and an expulsion in consequence from his church in Prague, he retired to Husinitz, his native place, where he continued to promulgate his new doctrine, both from the pulpit and with the pen. The letters which he wrote at this time were very numerous, and he compiled a treatise in which he maintained that reading the books of Protestants could not be absolutely forbidden. He wrote in defense of Wycliffe's book on the Trinity, and boldly declared against the vices of the Pope, the cardinals, and clergy of those corrupt times. He wrote also many other books, all of which were penned with a strength of argument that greatly facilitated the spreading of his doctrines. In the month of November, 1414, a general council was assembled at Constance, in Germany, in order, as was pretended, for the sole purpose of determining a dispute then pending between three persons who contended for the papacy, but the real motive was to crush the progress of the Reformation. John Huss was summoned to appear at this council, and, to encourage him, the emperor sent him a safe conduct. The civilities and even reverence which Huss met with on his journey were beyond imagination. The streets, and sometimes the very roads, were lined with people whom respect, rather than curiosity, had brought together. He was ushered into the town with great acclamations, and it may be said that he passed through Germany in a kind of triumph. He could not help expressing his surprise at the treatment he received. "I thought," said he, "I had been an outcast. I now see my worst friends are in Bohemia." As soon as Huss arrived at Constance, he immediately took lodgings in a remote part of the city. A short time after his arrival, came one Stephen Palitz, who was employed by the clergy at Prague to manage the intended prosecution against him. Palitz was afterwards joined by Michael de Cassis on the part of the court of Rome. These two declared themselves his accusers, and drew up a set of articles against him, which they presented to the Pope and the prelates of the council. When it was known that he was in the city, he was immediately arrested and committed prisoner to a chamber in the palace. This violation of common law and justice was particularly noticed by one of Huss's friends, who urged the imperial safe conduct, but the Pope replied he never granted any safe conduct, nor was he bound by that of the emperor. While Huss was in confinement, the council acted the part of inquisitors. They condemned the doctrines of Wycliffe, and even ordered his remains to be dug up and burned to ashes, which orders were strictly complied with. In the meantime, the nobility of Bohemia and Poland strongly interceded for Huss, and so far prevailed as to prevent his being condemned unheard, which had been resolved on by the commissioners appointed to try him. When he was brought before the council, the articles exhibited against him were read. They were upwards of 40 in number, and chiefly extracted from his writings. John Huss's answer was this: "I did appeal unto the Pope, who being dead, and the cause of my matter remaining undetermined, I appealed likewise unto his successor John 23, before whom, when, by the space of 2 years, I could not be admitted by my advocates to defend my cause, I appealed unto the High Judge Christ." When John Huss had spoken these words, it was demanded of him whether he had received absolution of the Pope or no. He answered, "No." Then again, whether it was lawful for him to appeal unto Christ or no. Whereunto John Huss answered, "Verily I do affirm here before you all, that there is no more just or effectual appeal, and that appeal which is made unto Christ, forasmuch as the law doth determine that to appeal is no other thing than in a cause of grief or wrong done by an inferior judge, to implore and require it at a higher judge's hand. Who is then a higher judge than Christ? Who, I say, can know, or judge the matter more justly, or with more equity? When in him there is found no deceit, neither can he be deceived, or who can better help the miserable and oppressed than he? While John Huss, with a devout and sober countenance, was speaking and pronouncing those words, he was derided and mocked by all the whole council. These excellent sentences were esteemed as so many expressions of treason, and tended to inflame his adversaries. Accordingly, the bishops appointed by the council stripped him of his priestly garments, degraded him, put a paper mitre on his head, on which was painted devils, with this inscription, "A ringleader of heretics." Which when he saw, he said, "My Lord Jesus Christ, for my sake, did wear a crown of thorns, why should not I then, for his sake, again wear the slight crown, be it ever so ignominious? Truly I will do it, and that willingly." When it was set upon his head, the bishop said, "Now we commit thy soul unto the devil." "But I," said John Huss, lifting his eyes towards the heaven, "do commend into thy hands, O Lord Jesus Christ, my spirit which thou hast redeemed." When the chain was put about him at the stake, he said, with a smiling countenance, "My Lord Jesus Christ was bound with a harder chain, and this for my sake, and why then should I be ashamed of this rusty one?" When the faggots were piled up to his very neck, the Duke of Bavaria was so officious as to desire him to abjure. "No," said Huss, "wink, I never preached any doctrine of an evil tendency, and what I taught with my lips I now seal with my blood." He then said to the executioner, "You are now going to burn a goose," Huss signifying goose, in the Bohemian language, smile, "but in a century you will have a swan which you can neither roast nor boil." If he were prophetic, he must have meant Martin Luther, who shone about 100 years after, and who had a swan for his arms. The flames were now applied to the faggots, when our martyr sung a hymn with so loud and cheerful a voice that he was heard through all the cracklings of the combustibles, and the noise of the multitude. At length his voice was interrupted by the severity of the flames, which soon closed his existence. Then, with great diligence, gathering the ashes together, they cast them into the river Rhine, that the least remnant of that man should not be left upon the earth, whose memory, notwithstanding, cannot be abolished out of the minds of the godly, neither by fire, neither by water, neither by any kind of torment. Persecution of Jerome of Prague. This reformer, who was the companion of Dr. Huss, and may be said to be a co-martyr with him, was born at Prague, and educated in that university, where he particularly distinguished himself for his great abilities and learning. He likewise visited several other learned seminaries in Europe, particularly the universities of Paris, Heidelberg, Cologne, and Oxford. At the latter place he became acquainted with the works of Wycliffe, and being a person of uncommon application, he translated many of them into his native language, having, with great pains, made himself master of the English tongue. On his return to Prague, he professed himself an open favorer of Wycliffe, and finding that his doctrines had made considerable progress in Bohemia, and that Huss was the principal promoter of them, he became an assistant to him in the great work of Reformation. On the 4th of April, 1415, Jerome arrived at Constance, about 3 months before the death of Huss. He entered the town privately, and consulting with some of the leaders of his party, whom he found there, was easily convinced he could not be of any service to his friends. Finding that his arrival in Constance was publicly known, and that the council intended to seize him, he thought it most prudent to retire. Accordingly, the next day he went to Eiberling, an imperial town, about a mile from Constance. From this place he wrote to the emperor, and proposed his readiness to appear before the council if he would give him a safe conduct, but this was refused. He then applied to the council, but met with an answer no less unfavorable than that from the emperor. After this, he set out on his return to Bohemia. He had the precaution to take with him a certificate, signed by several of the Bohemian nobility, then at Constance, testifying that he had used all prudent means in his power to procure a hearing. Jerome, however, did not thus escape. He was seized at Herzau by an officer belonging to the Duke of Sulzbach, who, though unauthorized so to act, made little doubt of obtaining thanks from the council for so acceptable a service. The Duke of Sulzbach, having Jerome now in his power, wrote to the council for directions how to proceed. The council, after expressing their obligations to the Duke, desired him to send the prisoner immediately to Constance. The Elector Palatine met him on the way and conducted him into the city, himself riding on horseback with a numerous retinue, who led Jerome in fetters by a long chain, and immediately on his arrival he was committed to a loathsome dungeon. Jerome was treated nearly in the same manner as Huss had been, only that he was much longer confined and shifted from one prison to another. At length, being brought before the council, he desired that he might plead his own cause and exculpate himself, which being refused him, he broke out into the following exclamation: "What barbarity is this? For 340 days have I been confined in a variety of prisons. There is not a misery, there is not a want, that I have not experienced. To my enemies you have allowed the fullest scope of accusation, to me you deny the least opportunity of defense. Not an hour will you now indulge me in preparing for my trial. You have swallowed the blackest calumnies against me, you have represented me as a heretic, without knowing my doctrine, as an enemy of the faith, before you knew what faith I professed, as a persecutor of priests, before you could have an opportunity of understanding my sentiments on that head. You are a general council, in whose center all this world can communicate of gravity, wisdom, and sanctity, but still you are men, and men are seducible by appearances. The higher your character is for wisdom, the greater ought your care to be not to deviate into folly. The cause I now plead is not my own cause, it is the cause of men, it is the cause of Christians, it is a cause which is to affect the rights of posterity, however the experiment is to be made in my person." This speech had not the least effect. Jerome was obliged to hear the charge read, which was reduced under the following heads: 1. That he was a derider of the papal dignity. 2. An opposer of the Pope. 3. An enemy to the cardinals. 4. A persecutor of the prelates. 5. A hater of the Christian religion. The trial of Jerome was brought on the third day, after his accusation and witnesses were examined in support of the charge. The prisoner was prepared for his defense, which appears almost incredible when we consider he had been 340 days shut up in loathsome prisons, deprived of daylight, and almost starved for want of common necessaries. But his spirit soared above these disadvantages, under which a man less animated would have sunk, nor was he more at a loss of quotations from the fathers and ancient authors, than if he had been furnished with the finest library. The most bigoted of the assembly were unwilling he should be heard, knowing what effect eloquence is apt to have on the minds of the most prejudiced. At length, however, it was carried by the majority that he should have liberty to proceed in his defense, which he began in such an exalted strain of moving elocution, that the heart of obdurate zeal was seen to melt, and the mind of superstition seemed to admit a ray of conviction. He made an admirable distinction between evidence, as resting upon facts, and as supported by malice and calumny. He laid before the assembly the whole tenor of his life and conduct. He observed that the greatest and most holy men had been known to differ in points of speculation, with a view to distinguish truth, not to keep it concealed. He expressed a noble contempt of all his enemies, who would have induced him to retract the cause of virtue and truth. He entered upon a high encomium of Huss, and declared he was ready to follow him in the glorious task of martyrdom. He then touched upon the most defensible doctrines of Wycliffe, and concluded with observing that it was far from his intention to advance anything against the state of the Church of God, that it was only against the abuse of the clergy he complained, and that he could not help saying, It was certainly impious that the patrimony of the Church, which was originally intended for the purpose of charity and universal benevolence, should be prostituted to the pride of the eye in feasts, foppish vestments, and other reproaches to the name and profession of Christianity. The trial being over, Jerome received the same sentence that had been passed upon his martyred countrymen. In consequence of this, he was, in the usual style of popish affectation, delivered over to the civil power, but, as he was a layman, he had not to undergo the ceremony of degradation. They had prepared a cap of paper painted with red devils, which being put upon his head, he said, "Our Lord Jesus Christ, when he suffered death for me a most miserable sinner, did wear a crown of thorns upon his head, and for his sake will I wear this cap." 2 days were allowed him in hopes that he would recant, in which time the Cardinal of Florence used his utmost endeavors to bring him over. But they all proved ineffectual. Jerome was resolved to seal the doctrine with his blood, and he suffered death with the most distinguished magnanimity. In going to the place of execution he sang several hymns, and when he came to the spot, which was the same where Huss had been burnt, he knelt down and prayed fervently. He embraced the stake with great cheerfulness, and when they went behind him to set fire to the faggots, he said, "Come here, and kindle it before my eyes, for if I had been afraid of it, I had not come to this place." The fire being kindled, he sang a hymn, but was soon interrupted by the flames, and the last words he was heard to say these, "This soul in flames I offer Christ to thee." The elegant Bog, a learned gentleman of Florence, secretary to two popes, and a zealous but liberal Catholic, in a letter to Leonard Aretin, bore ample testimony of the extraordinary powers and virtues of Jerome, whom he emphatically styles a prodigious man. Persecution of Ziska. The real name of this zealous servant of Christ was John de Trotsnow, that of Ziska is a Bohemian word, signifying one-eyed, as he had lost an eye. He was a native of Bohemia, of a good family, and left the court of Wenceslas to enter into the service of the King of Poland, against the Teutonic Knights. Having obtained a badge of honor and a purse of ducats for his gallantry, at the close of the war he returned to the court of Wenceslas, to whom he boldly avowed the deep interest he took in the bloody affront offered to His Majesty's subjects at Constance in the affair of Huss. Wenceslas lamented it was not in his power to revenge it, and from this moment Ziska is said to have formed the idea of asserting the religious liberties of his country. In the year 1418, the council was dissolved, having done more mischief than good, and in the summer of that year a general meeting was held of the Friends of Religious Reformation at the castle of Wiskrade, who, conducted by Ziska, repaired to the emperor with arms in their hands, and offered to defend him against his enemies. The king bid them use their arms properly, and this stroke of policy first ensured to Ziska the confidence of his party. Wenceslas was succeeded by Sigismund, his brother, who rendered himself odious to the reformers, and removed all such as were obnoxious to his government. Ziska and his friends, upon this, immediately flew to arms, declared war against the emperor and the pope, and laid siege to Pilsen with 40,000 men. They soon became masters of the fortress, and in a short time all the southwest part of Bohemia submitted, which greatly increased the army of the reformers. The latter having taken the pass of Modar, after a severe conflict of 5 days and nights, the emperor became alarmed, and withdrew his troops from the confines of Turkey, to march them into Bohemia. At Bern in Moravia he halted, and sent dispatches to treat of peace, as a preliminary to which Ziska gave up Pilsen, and all the fortresses he had taken. Sigismund, proceeding in a manner that clearly manifested he acted on the Roman doctrine, that no faith was to be kept with heretics, and treating some of the authors of the late disturbances with severity, the alarm bell of revolt was sounded from one end of Bohemia to the other. Ziska took the castle of Prague by the power of money, and on August 19, 1420, defeated the small army the emperor had hastily got together to oppose him. He next took Halzah by assault and destroyed the town with a barbarity that disgraced the cause in which he fought. Winter approaching, Ziska fortified his camp on a strong hill about 40 miles from Prague, which he called Mount Tabor, whence he surprised a body of horse at midnight and made 1,000 men prisoners. Shortly after, the emperor obtained possession of the strong fortress of Prague by the same means Ziska had before done. It was blockaded by the latter, and Wat began to threaten the emperor, who saw the necessity of retreat. Determined to make a desperate effort, Sigismund attacked the fortified camp of Ziska on Mount Tabor, and carried it with great slaughter. Many other fortresses also fell, and Ziska withdrew to a craggy hill, which he strongly fortified, and whence he so annoyed the emperor in his approaches against the town of Prague, that he found he must either abandon the siege or defeat his enemy. The Marquis of Misnia was deputed to effect this with a large body of troops, but the event was fatal to the imperialists. They were defeated, and the emperor, having lost nearly one-third of his army, retreated from the siege of Prague, harassed in his rear by the enemy. In the spring of 1421, Ziska commenced the campaign, as before, by destroying all the monasteries in his way. He laid siege to the castle of Wiskrade, and the emperor, coming to relieve it, fell into a snare, was defeated with dreadful slaughter, and this important fortress was taken. Our general had now leisure to attend to the work of reformation, but he was much disgusted with the gross ignorance and superstition of the Bohemian clergy, who rendered themselves contemptible in the eyes of the whole army. When he saw any symptoms of uneasiness in the camp, he would spread alarm in order to divert them and draw his men into action. In one of these expeditions, he encamped before the town of Ruby, and while pointing out the place for an assault, an arrow shot from the wall struck him in the eye. At Prague it was extracted, but, being barbed, it tore the eye out with it. A fever succeeded, and his life was with difficulty preserved. He was now totally blind, but still desirous of attending the army. The emperor, having summoned the states of the empire to assist him, resolved, with their assistance, to attack Ziska in the winter, when many of his troops departed until the return of spring. The Confederate princes undertook the siege of Soissons, but at the approach merely of the Bohemian general, they retreated. Sigismund nevertheless advanced with his formidable army, consisting of 15,000 Hungarian horse and 25,000 infantry, well equipped for a winter campaign. This army spread terror through all the east of Bohemia. Wherever Sigismund marched, the magistrates laid their keys at his feet, and were treated with severity or favor, according to their merits in his cause. Ziska, however, with speedy marches, approached, and the emperor resolved to try his fortune once more with that invincible chief. On the 13th of January, 1422, the two armies met on a spacious plain near Kremnitz. Ziska appeared in the center of his front line, guarded, or rather conducted, by a horseman on each side, armed with a poleaxe. His troops, having sung a hymn, with a determined coolness drew their swords, and waited for a signal. When his officers had informed him that the ranks were all well closed, he waved his saber round his head, which was the sign of battle. This battle is described as a most awful sight. The extent of the plain was one continued scene of disorder. The imperial army fled towards the confines of Moravia, the Taborites, without intermission, galling their rear. The river Eglot, then frozen, opposed their flight. The enemy pressing furiously, many of the infantry, and in a manner the whole body of the cavalry, attempted the river. The ice gave way, and not fewer than 2,000 were swallowed up in the water. Ziska now returned to Tabor, laden with all the spoils and trophies which the most complete victory could give. Ziska now began again to pay attention to the Reformation. He forbid all the prayers for the dead, images, sacerdotal vestments, fasts, and festivals. Priests were to be preferred according to their merits, and no one to be persecuted for religious opinions. In everything Ziska consulted the liberal-minded, and did nothing without general concurrence. An alarming disagreement now arose at Prague between the magistrates, who were calixtans, or receivers of the sacraments, in both kinds, and the Taborites, nine of the chiefs of whom were privately arraigned and put to death. The populace, enraged, sacrificed the magistrates, and the affair terminated without any particular consequence. The calixtans having sunk into contempt, Zisk was solicited to assume the crown of Bohemia, but this he nobly refused, and prepared for the next campaign, in which Sigismund resolved to make his last effort. While the Marquis of Misnia penetrated into Upper Saxony, the emperor proposed to enter Moravia, on the side of Hungary. Before the Marquis had taken the field, Ziska sat down before the strong town of Ausig, situated on the Elbe. The Marquis flew to its relief with his superior army, and, after an obstinate engagement, was totally defeated and Ausig capitulated. Ziska then went to the assistance of Prokop, a young general whom he had appointed to keep Sigismund in check, and whom he compelled to abandon the siege of Pernitz after laying 8 weeks before it. Ziska, willing to give his troops some respite from fatigue, now entered Prague, hoping his presence would quell any uneasiness that might remain after the late disturbance, but he was suddenly attacked by the people, and he and his troop, having beaten off the citizens, effected a retreat to his army, whom he acquainted with the treacherous conduct of the calixtans. Every effort of address was necessary to appease their vengeful animosity, and at night, in a private interview between Roxen, an ecclesiastic of great eminence in Prague, and Ziska, the latter became reconciled, and the intended hostilities were done away. Mutually tired of the war, Sigismund sent to Ziska, requesting him to sheath his sword, and name his conditions. A place of congress being appointed, Ziska, with his chief officers, set out to meet the emperor. Compelled to pass through a part of the country where the plague raged, he was seized with it at the castle of Briskaw, and departed this life, October 6, 1424. Like Moses, he died in view of the completion of his labors, and was buried in the great church of Czeslaw, in Bohemia, where a monument is erected to his memory, with this inscription on it: "Here lies John Ziska, who, having defended his country against the encroachments of papal tyranny, rests in this hallowed place, in despite of the Pope." After the death of Ziska, Prokop was defeated, and fell with the liberties of his country. After the death of Hus and Jerome, the Pope, in conjunction with the Council of Constance, ordered the Roman clergy everywhere to excommunicate such as adopted their opinions or commiserated their fate. These orders occasioned great contentions between the Papists and Reformed Bohemians, which was the cause of a violent persecution against the latter. At Prague, the persecution was extremely severe, until, at length, the Reformed, being driven to desperation, armed themselves, attacked the Senate House, and threw 12 senators, with the Speaker, out of the Senate House windows, whose bodies fell upon spears, which were held up by others of the Reformed in the street, to receive them. Being informed of these proceedings, the Pope came to Florence, and publicly excommunicated the Reformed Bohemians, exciting the Emperor of Germany, and all kings, princes, dukes, etc., to take up arms in order to extirpate the whole race, and promising, by way of encouragement, full remission of all sins whatever to the most wicked person, if he did but kill one Bohemian Protestant. This occasioned a bloody war, for several popish princes undertook the extirpation, or at least expulsion, of the proscribed people, and the Bohemians, arming themselves, prepared to repel force by force, in the most vigorous and effectual manner. The Popish army prevailing against the Protestant forces at the Battle of Cuttenberg, the prisoners of the Reformed were taken to three deep mines near that town, and several hundreds were cruelly thrown into each, where they miserably perished. A merchant of Prague, going to Breslau, in Silesia, happened to lodge in the same inn with several priests. Entering into conversation upon the subject of religious controversy, he passed many encomiums upon the martyr John Huss, and his doctrines. The priests taking umbrage at this, laid an information against him the next morning, and he was committed to prison as a heretic. Many endeavors were used to persuade him to embrace the Roman Catholic faith, but he remained steadfast to the pure doctrines of the Reformed Church. Soon after his imprisonment, a student of the university was committed to the same jail, when, being permitted to converse with the merchant, they mutually comforted each other. On the day appointed for execution, when the jailer began to fasten ropes to their feet, by which they were to be dragged through the streets, the student appeared quite terrified, and offered to abjure his faith and turn Roman Catholic, if he might be saved. The offer was accepted, his abjuration was taken by a priest, and he was set at liberty. A priest applying to the merchant to follow the example of the student, he nobly said, "Lose no time in hopes of my recantation, your expectations will be vain. I sincerely pity that poor wretch, who has miserably sacrificed his soul for a few more uncertain years of a troublesome life, and, so far from having the least idea of following his example, I glory in the very thoughts of dying for the sake of Christ." On hearing these words, the priest ordered the executioner to proceed, and the merchant being drawn through the city was brought to the place of execution, and there burnt. Pichel, a bigoted popish magistrate, apprehended 24 Protestants, among whom was his daughter's husband. As they all owned they were of the Reformed religion, he indiscriminately condemned them to be drowned in the River Abyss. On the day appointed for the execution, a great concourse of people attended, among whom was Pichel's daughter. This worthy wife threw herself at her father's feet, bedewed them with tears, and in the most pathetic manner, implored him to commiserate her sorrow, and pardon her husband. The obdurate magistrate sternly replied, "Intercede not for him, child, he is a heretic, a vile heretic." To which she nobly answered, "Whatever his faults may be, or however his opinions may differ from yours, he is still my husband, a name which, at a time like this, should alone employ my whole consideration." Pichel flew into a violent passion, and said, "You are mad. Cannot you, after the death of this, have a much worthier husband?" "No, sir," replied she, "my affections are fixed upon this, and death itself shall not dissolve my marriage vow." Pichel, however, continued inflexible, and ordered the prisoners to be tied with their hands and feet behind them, and in that manner be thrown into the river. As soon as this was put into execution, the young lady watched her opportunity, leaped into the waves, and embracing the body of her husband, both sank together into one watery grave. An uncommon instance of conjugal love in a wife, and of an inviolable attachment to, and personal affection for, her husband. The Emperor Ferdinand, whose hatred to the Bohemian Protestants was without bounds, not thinking he had sufficiently oppressed them, instituted a high court of reformers, upon the plan of the Inquisition, with this difference, that the reformers were to remove from place to place, and always to be attended by a body of troops. These reformers consisted chiefly of Jesuits, and from their decision, there was no appeal, by which it may be easily conjectured that it was a dreadful tribunal indeed. This bloody court, attended by a body of troops, made the tour of Bohemia, in which they seldom examined or saw a prisoner, suffering the soldiers to murder the Protestants as they pleased, and then to make a report of the matter to them afterward. The first victim of their cruelty was an aged minister, whom they killed as he lay sick in his bed. The next day they robbed and murdered another, and soon after shot a third, as he was preaching in his pulpit. A nobleman and clergyman, who resided in a Protestant village, hearing of the approach of the High Court of Reformers and the troops, fled from the place and secreted themselves. The soldiers, however, on their arrival, seized upon a schoolmaster, asked him where the lord of that place and the minister were concealed, and where they had hidden their treasures. The schoolmaster replied that he could not answer either of the questions. They then stripped him naked, bound him with cords, and beat him most unmercifully with cudgels. This cruelty not extorting any confession from him, They scorched him in various parts of his body, when, to gain a respite from his torments, he promised to show them where the treasures were hid. The soldiers gave ear to this with pleasure, and the schoolmaster led them to a ditch full of stones, saying, "Beneath these stones are the treasures ye seek for." Eager after money, they went to work, and soon removed those stones, but not finding what they sought after, they beat the schoolmaster to death, buried him in the ditch, and covered him with the very stones he had made them remove. Some of the soldiers ravished the daughters of a worthy Protestant before his face, and then tortured him to death. A minister and his wife they tied back to back, and burnt. Another minister they hung upon a crossbeam, and making a fire under him, broiled him to death. A gentleman they hacked into small pieces, and they filled a young man's mouth with gunpowder, and setting fire to it, blew his head to pieces. As their principal rage was directed against the clergy, they took a pious Protestant minister, and tormenting him daily for a month together, in the following manner, making their cruelty regular, systematic, and progressive. They placed him amidst them, and made him the subject of their derision and mockery, during a whole day's entertainment, trying to exhaust his patience, but in vain, for he bore the whole with true Christian fortitude. They spit in his face, pulled his nose, and pinched him in most parts of his body. He was hunted, like a wild beast, until ready to expire with fatigue. They made him run the gauntlet between two ranks of them, each striking him with its wig. He was beat with their fists. He was beat with ropes. They scourged him with wires. He was beat with cudgels. They tied him up by the heels with his head downwards, until the blood started out of his nose, mouth, etc. They hung him by the right arm until it was dislocated, and then had it set again. The same was repeated with his left arm. Burning papers dipped in oil were placed between his fingers and toes. His flesh was torn with red-hot pincers. He was put to the rack. They pulled off the nails of his right hand. The same repeated with his left hand. He was bastinadoed on his feet. A slit was made in his right ear. The same repeated on his left ear. His nose was slit. They whipped him through the town upon an ass. They made several incisions in his flesh. They pulled off the toenails of his right foot. The same they repeated with his left foot. He was tied up by the loins and suspended for a considerable time. The teeth of his upper jaw were pulled out. The same was repeated with his lower jaw. Boiling lead was poured upon his fingers. The same was repeated with his toes. A knotted cord was twisted about his forehead in such a manner as to force out his eyes. During the whole of these horrid cruelties, particular care was taken that his wounds should not mortify and not to injure him mortally until the last day, when the forcing out of his eyes proved his death. Innumerable were the other murders and depredations committed by those unfeeling brutes, and shocking to humanity were the cruelties which they inflicted on the poor Bohemian Protestants. The winter being far advanced, however, the High Court of Reformers, with their infernal band of military ruffians, thought proper to return to Prague, but on their way, meeting with a Protestant pastor, they could not resist the temptation of feasting their barbarous eyes with a new kind of cruelty, which had just suggested itself to the diabolical imagination of one of the soldiers. This was to strip the minister naked, and alternately to cover him with eyes and burning coals. This novel mode of tormenting a fellow creature was immediately put into practice, and the unhappy victim expired beneath the torments, which seemed to delight his inhuman persecutors. A secret order was soon after issued by the emperor for apprehending all noblemen and gentlemen who had been principally concerned in supporting the Protestant cause, and in nominating Frederick Elector Palatine of the Rhine to be king of Bohemia. These, to the number of 50, were apprehended in one night, and at one hour, and brought from the places where they were taken, to the castle of Prague, and the estates of those who were absent from the kingdom were confiscated, themselves were made outlaws, and their names fixed upon a gallows as marks of public ignominy. The High Court of Reformers then proceeded to try the 50 who had been apprehended, and two apostate Protestants were appointed to examine them. These examinants asked a great number of unnecessary and impertinent questions, which so exasperated one of the noblemen, who was naturally of a warm temper, that he exclaimed, opening his breast at the same time, "Cut here, search my heart, you shall find nothing but the love of religion and liberty. Those were the motives for which I drew my sword, and for those I am willing to suffer death." As none of the prisoners would change their religion, or acknowledge they had been in error, they were all pronounced guilty, but the sentence was referred to the emperor. When that monarch had read their names, and an account of the respective accusations against them, he passed judgment on all, but in a different manner, as his sentences were of four kinds, viz. Death, banishment, imprisonment for life, and imprisonment during pleasure. 20 being ordered for execution, were informed they might send for Jesuits, monks, or friars, to prepare for the awful change they were to undergo, but that no Protestants should be permitted to come near them. This proposal they rejected, and strove all they could to comfort and cheer each other upon the solemn occasion. On the morning of the day appointed for the execution, a cannon was fired, as a signal to bring the prisoners from the castle to the principal marketplace, in which scaffolds were erected, and a body of troops were drawn up to attend the tragic scene. The prisoners left the castle with as much cheerfulness as if they had been going to an agreeable entertainment instead of a violent death. Exclusive of soldiers, Jesuits, priests, executioners, attendants, etc., a prodigious concourse of people attended to see the exit of these devoted martyrs, who were executed in the following order. Lord Shillock was about 50 years of age, and was possessed of great natural and acquired abilities. When he was told he was to be quartered, and his part scattered in different places, he smiled with great serenity, saying, "The loss of a sepulchre is but a trifling consideration." A gentleman who stood by, crying, "Courage, my lord!" He replied, "I have God's favor, which is sufficient to inspire anyone with courage. The fear of death does not trouble me. Formerly I have faced him in fields of battle to oppose Antichrist, and now dare face him on a scaffold for the sake of Christ." Having said a short prayer, he told the executioner he was ready. He cut off his right hand and his head, and then quartered him. His hand and his head were placed upon the high tower of Prague, and his quarters distributed in different parts of the city. Lord Viscount Wenceslas, who had attained the age of 70 years, was equally respectable for learning, piety, and hospitality. His temper was so remarkably patient that when his house was broken open, his property seized, and his estates confiscated, he only said, with great composure, "The Lord hath given, and the Lord hath taken away." Being asked why he could engage in so dangerous a cause as that of attempting to support the Elector Palatine Frederick against the power of the Emperor, he replied, "I acted strictly according to the dictates of my conscience, and, to this day, deem him my king. I am now full of years, and wish to lay down life, that I may not be a witness of the further evils which are to attend my country. You have long thirsted for my blood, take it, for God will be my avenger." Then approaching the block, he stroked his long, gray beard, and said, "Venerable heirs, the great honor now attends ye, a crown of martyrdom is your portion." Then laying down his head, it was severed from his body at one stroke, and placed upon a pole in a conspicuous part of the city. Lord Heron was a man of good sense, great piety, and much experience gained by travel, as he had visited the principal places in Europe, Asia, and Africa. Hence he was free from national prejudices, and had collected much knowledge. The accusations against this nobleman were his being a Protestant, and having taken an oath of allegiance to Frederick, Elector Palatine, of the Rhine, as King of Bohemia. When he came upon the scaffold he said, I have traveled through many countries and traversed various barbarous nations, yet never found so much cruelty as at home. I have escaped innumerable perils both by sea and land, and surmounted inconceivable difficulties to suffer innocently in my native place. My blood is likewise sought by those for whom I and my forefathers have hazarded our estates, but, Almighty God, forgive them, for they know not what they do. He then went to the block, kneeled down, and exclaimed with great energy, Into thy hands, O Lord! I commend my spirit, in thee have I always trusted, receive me, therefore, my blessed Redeemer. The fatal stroke was then given, and a period put to the temporary pains of this life. Lord Frederick de Bile suffered, as a Protestant, and a promoter of the late war. He met his fate with serenity, and only said he wished well to the friends whom he left behind, forgave the enemies who caused his death, denied the authority of the emperor in that country, acknowledged Frederick to be the only true king of Bohemia, and hoped for salvation in the merits of his blessed Redeemer. Lord Henry Otto, when he first came upon the scaffold, seemed greatly confounded, and said, with some asperity, as if addressing himself to the emperor, Thou tyrant Ferdinand, your throne is established in blood, but if you will kill my body, and disperse my members, they shall still rise up in judgment against you. He then was silent, and having walked about for some time, seemed to recover his fortitude, and growing calm, said to a gentleman who stood near, I was, a few minutes since, greatly discomposed, but now I feel my spirits revive. God be praised for affording me such comfort. Death no longer appears as the king of terrors, but seems to invite me to participate of some unknown joys. Kneeling before the block, he said, Almighty God, to thee I commend my soul, receive it for the sake of Christ, and admit it to the glory of thy presence. The executioner put this nobleman to considerable pain by making several strokes before he severed the head from the body. The Earl of Regina was distinguished for his superior abilities and unaffected piety. On the scaffold he said, We who drew our swords fought only to preserve the liberties of the people and to keep our consciences sacred. As we were overcome, I am better pleased at the sentence of death, and if the emperor had given me life, for I find that it pleases God to have his truth defended, not by our swords, but by our blood. He then went boldly to the block, saying, I shall now be speedily with Christ, and receive the crown of martyrdom with great courage. Sir Gaspar Caplitz was 86 years of age. When he came to the place of execution, he addressed the principal officer thus, Behold a miserable ancient man, who hath often entreated God to take him out of this wicked world, but could not until now obtain his desire, for God reserved me until these years to be a spectacle to the world and a sacrifice to himself, therefore God's will be done. One of the officers told him, in consideration of his great age, that if he would only ask pardon, he would immediately receive it. Ask pardon, exclaimed he, I will ask pardon of God, whom I have frequently offended, but not of the emperor, to whom I never gave any offense. Should I sue for pardon, it might be justly suspected I had committed some crime for which I deserved this condemnation. No, no, as I die innocent, and with a clear conscience, I would not be separated from this noble company of martyrs. So saying, he cheerfully resigned his neck to the block. Procopius Dorzecki on the scaffold said, We are now under the emperor's judgment, but in time he shall be judged, and we shall appear as witnesses against him. Then taking a gold medal from his neck, which was struck when the Elector Frederick was crowned King of Bohemia, he presented it to one of the officers, at the same time uttering these words, As a dying man, I request, if ever King Frederick is restored to the throne of Bohemia, that you will give him this medal. Tell him, for his sake, I wore it until death, and that now I willingly lay down my life for God and my king. He then cheerfully laid down his head, and submitted to the fatal blow. Dionysius Servius was brought up a Roman Catholic, but had embraced the Reformed religion for some years. When upon the scaffold the Jesuits used their utmost endeavors to make him recant and return to his former faith, but he paid not the least attention to their exhortations. Kneeling down he said, "They may destroy my body, but cannot injure my soul, that I commend to my Redeemer," and then patiently submitted to martyrdom, being at that time 56 years of age. Valentine Cochin was a person of considerable fortune and eminence, perfectly pious and honest, but of trifling abilities, yet his imagination seemed to grow bright, and his faculties to improve on death's approach, as if the impending danger refined the understanding. Just before he was beheaded, he expressed himself with such eloquence, energy, and precision as greatly amazed those who knew his former deficiency in point of capacity. Tobias Stefik was remarkable for his affability and serenity of temper. He was perfectly resigned to his fate, and a few minutes before his death spoke in this singular manner, "I have received, during the whole course of my life, many favors from God. Ought I not therefore cheerfully to take one bitter cup when he thinks proper to present it? Or rather, ought I not to rejoice that it is his will I should give up a corrupted life for that of immortality?" Dr. Jansenius, an able student of physic, was accused of having spoken disrespectful words of the emperor, of treason in swearing allegiance to the Elector Frederick, and of heresy in being a Protestant. For the first accusation he had his tongue cut out, for the second he was beheaded, and for the third, and last, he was quartered, and the respective parts exposed on poles. Christopher Chober, as soon as he stepped upon the scaffold, said, "I come in the name of God to die for his glory. I have fought the good fight, and finished my course, so, executioner, do your office." The executioner obeyed, and he instantly received the crown of martyrdom. No person ever lived more respected or died more lamented than John Schultes. The only words he spoke, before receiving the fatal stroke, were, "The righteous seem to die in the eyes of fools, but they only go to rest. Lord Jesus, thou hast promised that those who come to thee shall not be cast off. Behold, I am come, look on me, pity me, pardon my sins, and receive my soul." Maximilian Hostiolek was famed for his learning, piety, and humanity. When he first came on the scaffold, he seemed exceedingly terrified at the approach of death. The officer taking notice of his agitation, Hostiolek said, "Ah, sir, now the sins of my youth crowd upon my mind, but I hope God will enlighten me, lest I sleep the sleep of death, and lest mine enemies say we have prevailed." Soon after he said, "I hope my repentance is sincere, and will be accepted, in which case the blood of Christ will wash me from my crimes." He then told the officer he should repeat the Song of Simeon, at the conclusion of which the executioner might do his duty. He accordingly said, "Lord, now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace, according to thy word, for mine eyes have seen thy salvation," at which words his head was struck off at one blow. When John Cutnauer came to the place of execution, a Jesuit said to him, "Embrace the Roman Catholic faith, which alone can save and arm you against the terrors of death." To which he replied, "Your superstitious faith I abhor, it leads to perdition, and I wish for no other arms against the terrors of death, and a good conscience." The Jesuit turned away, saying, sarcastically, "The Protestants are impenetrable rocks." "You are mistaken," said Cutnauer, "it is Christ that is the rock, and we are firmly fixed upon him. This person not being born independent, but having acquired a fortune by a mechanical employment, was ordered to be hanged. Just before he was turned off, he said, 'I die, not for having committed any crime, but for following the dictates of my own conscience, and defending my country and religion.'" Simeon Sosikai was father-in-law to Cutnauer, and like him, was ordered to be executed on a gallows. He went cheerfully to death, and appeared impatient to be executed, saying, "Every moment delays me from entering into the kingdom of Christ." Nathaniel Wodnitonsky was hanged for having supported the Protestant cause and the election of Frederick to the crown of Bohemia. At the gallows, the Jesuits did all in their power to induce him to renounce his faith. Finding their endeavors ineffectual, one of them said, "If you will not abjure your heresy, at least repent of your rebellion." To which Wodnitonsky replied, "You take away our lives under a pretended charge of rebellion, and, not content with that, seek to destroy our souls. Glut yourselves with blood, and be satisfied, but tamper not with our consciences." Wodnitonsky's own son then approached the gallows and said to his father, "Sir, if life should be offered to you on condition of apostasy, I entreat you to remember Christ and reject such pernicious overtures." To this the father replied, "It is very acceptable, my son, to be exhorted to constancy by you, but suspect me not, rather endeavor to confirm in their faith your brothers, sisters, and children, and teach them to imitate that constancy of which I shall leave them an example." He had so sooner concluded these words, and he was turned off, receiving the crown of martyrdom with great fortitude. Wenceslas Gizbitsky, during his whole confinement, had great hopes of life given him, which made his friends fear for the safety of his soul. He, however, continued steadfast in his faith, prayed fervently at the gallows, and met his fate with singular resignation. Martin Foster was an ancient cripple, the accusations against whom were being charitable to heretics and lending money to the Elector Frederick. His great wealth, however, seemed to have been his principal crime, and that he might be plundered of his treasures was the occasion of his being ranked in this illustrious list of martyrs.